I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and thank you for joining the Magazine Show podcast brought to you by Golster, the experts in health and well-being, with a range of fascinating guests who stimulate, educate, and make us laugh. Hello and welcome to the Golster Magazine Show at a special time of 7 in the evening in London, because we are going thousands of miles to the west, where the sun is high in the sky in California, and that's the place that's on the cutting edge of new things, technology, music, and health and well-being. This is where ideas flourish and things grow. I am Humphrey Hawksley, and my guest has spent a career working on the science around preventative healthcare. His two current projects underpin exactly what he does and his life's passion and his work, the future of human care, health, innovation, and social impact, and a six-part documentary film and book, Paradigm Shift, A Wellness Revolution. What exactly is that? Golster is so lucky to have him for an hour of incisive conversation. He is also engaged with Scientific American on a project, Healthspan, Living Better Longer, and strategic advisor to Nature Portfolio in London, developing a global project, Building Sustainable Healthcare Systems. That's specifically aimed at transforming healthcare from that focus on disease to one on wellness and prevention. We're going to talk a lot about that. He's helped create a media project sponsored by Google and Phenome Health called The New Science of Wellbeing. Get my drift? All of this is right up Golster Street, and he's not a complete stranger to our shores, because as a young man brimming with curiosity and drive, he earned his doctorate from Cambridge University, and more recently, from 2022 to 23, he was a visiting fellow at Oxford University's Martin School and St. Anthony's College, where he advised on life sciences. Welcome, Robert Kilpatrick, to the Golster Magazine Show.
Hello, Humphrey, and greetings to everybody on this call. I'm so glad to be a part of this. I feel honored. And Humphrey, the person you described, when I look in the mirror, I'm not sure I recognize that person, but you're a very kind host, and I love that introduction. Thank you.
And is it sunny over there? I know you're in a room, but we're in the end of a long winter here. So tell us what it's like over in California.
Well, the sad truth is that we have been in the midst of what's called a series of aerial rivers. So California has been inundated with rainstorm after rainstorm. And in the Sierra Nevada mountains and Lake Tahoe, they now have 50 feet of snow.
Oh my
goodness. Climate change has brought lots of rain, which we need, to drought-stricken California, for which I am grateful because I was born here.
And as a native Californian, was I right saying that this is the place where there are new ideas and innovations of which you're at the heart of?
Apparently, and that's why there's so much traffic during commute hours.
Now, bring us back to the beginning. You said you were born in California. You are now at the heart of the health and well-being global revolution that we hope is happening. You told me earlier that when you were a kid, you wanted to be an explorer. So what was the catalyst or whatever that took you into healthcare?
Well, that's a good question, and I've thought a lot about that. So there's kind of a positive angle, and there's kind of more of a negative angle to that. The positive angle is that I was raised in the country at the end of a kind of Steinbeckian California, when the population was much smaller, and where I lived was surrounded by orchards and farms and fruit and animals. And so I had kind of what I call a free-range childhood. I would leave the house and my mother wouldn't know where I was until dinner time. So being raised close to nature, I really understood from a very early age the power of healing and life. All living things have this restorative power. And of course, if you think about that, that applies to a cut on your hand or, cutting a branch off of a tree. So I was exposed constantly to the healing power of nature. That was the positive side. The negative side of it was that my father had been in World War II. He had a collection of books called The Pictorial History of World War II. I was home alone. Maybe I was 5 years old. I pulled one of these books off the shelf, and I looked at some of the pictures, and there was this photograph of a pile of human cadavers in a concentration camp. And I didn't even know what it was. So he eventually came home and he said, "How did your day go?" And I said, "Daddy, I saw something I need you to explain to me." And he said, "Well, what is it?" And I showed him this picture and I said, "What is this?" And he said, "Son, well, I have to tell you something." And so in that moment, my kind of naive childhood was shattered. And he said, "Human beings are capable of creating the greatest beauty imaginable, cathedrals, you know, music, you know, fast cars. But on the other hand, human beings are capable of the most awful things, war and murder. And these people were killed because other people didn't like them." And I never forgot that. And it was like somehow this idea of the innate restorative healing quality of nature combined with the human ability to destroy life, to harm people, came together. And I realized that I was either going to become a priest in the church or I was going to become a doctor. And that was really how my course started.
So you became a physician, a medical doctor?
No, because I was going to do an MD, PhD, and I was at Berkeley as an undergraduate. And then I had an opportunity to go to Brown in Providence. But I was interested in so many different things that it was hard for me to specialize. And then in 1973, you may remember, there was a 13-part television series called The Ascent of Man, which featured Professor Jacob Bernofsky, in which he looked at the history of science from the Greeks to the modern times. It's available on YouTube. You can see it now. So we go through 12 episodes of Hippocrates and Isaac Newton and the Reformation and all this stuff and everything modern. And then in the final 13th segment, he's walking in this field. And as he approaches the camera, he basically says, "I am in the Auschwitz concentration camp and in Poland." And I wrote down his exact words because I want to say what he said. He said, "There are the ashes of 4 million people in this pond. It was not done by gas. It was done by arrogance. It was done by dogma. It was done by ignorance. When people believe they have absolute knowledge with no test in reality, this is how they behave." And suddenly I was transported back to being a 5-year-old boy with the pictures of that camp.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, I don't want to be a doctor. I want to study the history and philosophy of science, and I want to go to Cambridge and be in his department. And that's how it all happened. And it was those two images of the opposite of healing, hurt and harm, the concentration camp images that propelled me into the field of health, well-being, and healing.
And what did you learn as a student under him that brought you to the Goldstone Magazine show today?
Well, two things.
Nugget there.
Two things. That's a good question. The first thing is I learned how to think. So searching the web for information is not really thinking. Reading books is not necessarily thinking. Even George Bernard Shaw said, "Reading rots the mind." So it's what I learned at Cambridge was how to ask questions. And as an anatomy professor of mine at Berkeley, Marion Diamond used to say, you have to ask the right question to get the right answer. So in order to ask the right question, you have to be able to think. And so that's a whole process, and that's what I learned. The second thing I learned, and I have a prop to show you, is I read this book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn, who in 1963 published this book in which he presented the concept of a paradigm shift. And so I read the book, and then I taught undergraduates about this book and about paradigm shift. My thesis is about a paradigm shift. And what a paradigm shift is it's a fundamentally new way of thinking and acting in the world. So right now, the dominant paradigm in healthcare in the UK and in the United States is focused on disease. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll until something breaks, and you go to the doctor, you go to the body mechanic, and you say, "Please fix me." There's very little prevention involved. So the paradigm shift is a shift from a focus on disease to more of a focus on wellness and prevention. And we'll talk about more about that in the
course. Definitely, we're gonna talk about that a lot. And I want you to take us back to those days in the 70s. But before we do that, I want to point out to our wonderful audience there that just to the right or left, I can never work out these things, of Robert's shoulder, you will see some musical instruments, which are saxophones. Now, at the end of the show, Robert is going to play us out with a very famous song. And this is, what you said, teach us to think. You can't just watch this, so you have to think. So look at Robert. You see his rough age. You can see his manner and his demeanor. Guess what song Robert is going to play us out on. Put it in the chat. There's no right answer because he might change his mind at the end. I think I know what it is. Put it in the chat and let's see what happens there. And also, as we talk about this, particularly the wellness, health, and well-being, anything you want to ask, just ask it or comment on it, and we will throw it into our discussion. Take us back to the 70s, as you were saying, and you're talking about a paradigm shift. So the paradigm then, you go and see a doctor, and you have an ache or you're feeling down, what we might call depression nowadays or something. What would that doctor say? What would he have said to you then as opposed to what happens now?
Well, most certainly then it would have been a he. And so one of the big changes between then and now is that, you know, in some cases there are now more women in medical school than men. So that's a big change. And it's not the topic of this conversation today about how the female might deliver care differently from the male, but there could be some differences. So that'd be the first thing. I think the thing that hasn't really changed is that then and now, primarily a focus on disease. You know, so you see your general practitioner and they do a bunch of tests and they're a bit like Sherlock Holmes. I mean, they're looking for something that they can find that's gone wrong. So you don't go to a GP or a specialist physician for dietary instruction, you know, for exercise instruction, for meditation, massage. So you go to the doctor when you think something's wrong. You have a pain or it feels wrong. And that was the same in the 70s, and that is the same now. What is different now, of course, is that we have fitness gyms. They were very unusual at that time. We have massage therapists. We have traditional Chinese medicine practitioners. So nowadays, there's all sorts of other ways to build your health. And I think that's an important concept, to build your health as a positive state of being, as a form of wealth. But if you go see a GP, a person who was trained at university and a medical school, in almost every case, they are trained to diagnose, to treat, and manage disease. They may not even know more about health than you do, and you may even know more than they do.
Okay, so we know that if we have a pain or something, we go to a doctor. But on the wellness and health and well-being side, is there a single umbrella thing that we go to? Goldster is doing this, and we've only been doing it for 2 or 3 years. But is there, I can't think where I live, as you were saying that, there isn't a place I can say, do I need a massage? Do I need Pilates? Do I need cardiovascular? Is it there?
Well, let me speak about where I live, which is, you know, on the edge of Silicon Valley. I live in Santa Cruz County, which is just over the mountains from Palo Alto and Stanford and these types of places. And I think what is true in California is probably true across the United States, which is your health status and the health outcomes that you will have over the course of your life, how long you will live, how many illnesses you'll have, is directly correlated to what we call your zip code, what you call the postcode.
Right.
So there are examples, and I'm sure this is true in London and Birmingham and other places, but right here, there are examples of people living 1 mile apart, and the difference in in longevity is 13 years. So
why would that be?
Well, that's because the zip code is related to where you live, and where you live is related to the cost of housing, for example. So like in London, for example, you know, in social housing in Chelsea versus, you know, Cheyne Walk, there could be a £5 million difference between a flat in one place or the other. So people who can afford a $5 million flat versus living in social housing, the people with the resources, they can afford concierge medicine or what you might call private medicine. They can afford very nice gyms. They can afford all kinds of preventative treatments, facials, private trainers. So I think that there is a growing, actually, wellness industry, but it's not universally provided. So in the UK, you have the National Health Service, which treats people regardless of their postcode. And then people who have more resources can choose for private if they want to. But that's a small group of the population. So the problem with wellness prevention and wellness programs here in California is that they are not universally provided. So they're either provided to wealthier people who can afford to pay, or in some cases they're provided through employment. So tech companies like Google and Apple, who have a younger...
just to get it clear, what is needed, or is this what you're suggesting, is a place that I could go to, or you could go to, that says that looks at your diet, that looks at your posture, that looks at your cognitive outlook on life, and gives you something that's not a drug, not necessarily a physician prescribed, but a well-being expert's prescribed.
Yeah. Yes, Humphrey. So the idea behind paradigm shift, which is, you know, a completely new way of thinking about how to keep people healthy, this shift from a focus on disease to a focus on wellness and prevention, in order for that to happen, we're going to need, for example, innovation in how healthcare is funded. So we're going to need economic incentives for people to stay healthy. Whereas now, the incentives are, if you're lucky and your employer gives you some insurance in the United States, that you'll be taken care of when something breaks. So there's no real incentive to stay healthy, because if you drink too much and eat too much and don't exercise, you can go to the doctor and you can be treated and given a pill. So what's lacking, and what we're working on as part of the Paradigm Shift Initiative, is what are the economic arguments for a healthcare system that's focused on wellness and prevention? Where can the inducements to change be created? What are the incentives, both at an individual level, like why should I change my life? Why should you change your life? Why should this audience change their lives? So that's individually. And then we have issues around populations. You know, how do we deal with this 13-year longevity gap between one zip code at the lower social and one zip code at the higher? So,
you said the economic differences of it. Do you have very broad figures like this, that if people were on a wellness routine, it would save the hospitals X amount?
Well, that's not exactly, because the problem is that the way the dominant paradigm operates now, and in the United States, we have a $4 trillion annual healthcare spend, and 86% of it go for five chronic diseases that are in many cases preventable. So the population is aging, so everyone at some point is developing certain chronic diseases because we don't have a wellness and prevention system. Basically, people wait until it's relatively late stage for it to be diagnosed. And the later the stage, the more complicated the treatments and the management, and the more expensive. So Sir John Bell, who's the Regius Professor of Medicine at the University of Oxford, who has a quote in our Nature Portfolio Project, Building Sustainable Healthcare Systems, and he says, provocatively, there is no healthcare system in the world today that is sustainable. And every healthcare system that exists on the planet, including the NHS, the Americans, the Canadians, Australians, because they're focused on disease and because people are living longer and getting more diseases, they're all going to go bankrupt. So this paradigm shift is not just some fanciful idea that I and others have. It actually has a strong economic underpinning because we're trying to save the ship before it capsizes.
And this might not be connected, but I have the opioid crisis where millions of people get addicted to prescribed drugs. Is that part of what we're talking about, or is that something separate?
Well, you know, that's a good question. And I've actually, in a way, was prepared for this because I wanted to say something, which is the word health, the root, the etymology of the word health is whole. So health means wholeness, but it also means the whole story. So when you start talking about diseases or an addiction or something like that, what you are excluding from the whole story is the social determinants of health, how people live, where they live, what their financial status is, are they barely surviving month to month? Do they have a good job or not? Is the air or water polluted? You know, so I think that what we're really talking about and what I believe Goldster's focused on is whole human health. We are not cells. You know, we are not atoms. We are whole human, you know, top to bottom, left to right. We are whole human beings and we are social beings. We're not just biological. In fact, we are not biological machines because we're not machines. We're living, breathing souls.
We are part of that nature that you grew up with as a child, and you were seeing the animals and the plants and everything, and you were just part of that.
Well, that's why I think language is important, because, you know, you've heard everyone talk about human nature. Well, there's the word nature, yeah. right there. And I also think that whatever the physics and the chemistry that exists in a blade of grass or in the hoof of a cow, it operates exactly the same as it does in us. But, you know, we're a different form of life. But life has pretty much everything in common in terms of healing powers, ailing powers. And I think that every living thing has an innate healing power. And I think that should be the starting point for talking about wellness and prevention and healthcare. How can we harness the innate healing power in every person on this call to step by step by step improve our health trajectory over the course of our lives?
I'm going to pause our discussion. I'm not pausing it. I'm going on a tangent because we have some answers to what you're going to be playing us out at the end of the under the thing. Pauline Blasey says, she would like it to be, it's turning into a request show, Robert. She would like it to be Breaking Glass. It's a classic. Do you know that one?
I do.
You do? I'm sure. What a Wonderful World. That's Louis Armstrong, isn't it? I'm sure you know that one too.
It was one of the ones who sang it, yes.
Yeah. A Baker Street or Smooth Operator.
You have an audience with excellent taste. I'll do it about it.
We do. I'll Do It My Way. Isn't that the Frank Sinatra song?
It is, yeah.
Oh, could you do Staying Alive?
Oh, my God. I don't have a white suit on.
And we've done Baker Street, haven't we? Two for Baker Street. But this is not a request show. It's a guest show. And I don't think we're there yet. So keep guessing because we haven't nailed it. Let's go through your projects because and nail down the discussion as well as the music. And now just the future of human care, health, innovation, and social impact. What are you doing there?
So that's a book that I started writing when I was in Oxford last year. And basically it embodies a lot of the things we've been talking about so far, which is, the philosopher Alexander Pope said that the appropriate study of of mankind as man. So nowadays it would be man and woman, or it would be humanity. So, you know, the idea that if you actually put people at the center of the story, that you would have a different story from, say, talking about the economics of healthcare or the technology of healthcare or whatever. So I'll give you an example of what this book's narrative arc would look like. In the first chapter, it is the title is an N of 8 billion. And so what that means is every human being alive today on the planet. And the question I start with is, what is it that all human beings, regardless of race, color, creed, national origin, gender, whatever, what is it that every human being needs in order to, at the most basic level, survive, you know, as an animal or a mammal? So you need clear water, clean water, you need, you know, nutritious food, you need shelter. Not everybody in the world, or not everybody in the UK or the US even have this. So there are some people that have extreme amounts of this and other people that have none or some. So the beginning of the book is looking for the universal nature of human beings. What is it that we could agree that everybody needs? And I think if we were aware of that, we could begin to think about a paradigm shift in healthcare, because most people are not sick, you know, at any given time, but they might get sick if they're lacking some very important.
And this is this not the playbook of the developing world aid? I mean, water, sanitation, and nutrition, and that sort of thing that we're looking at. But you want to place that in California or in
no, it's a global story, Humphrey. But the first chapter is an N of 8 billion, and the final chapter is an N of 1. And so we'll have gone from the beginning of the book looking at all the things that are prerequisites for human beings, for people, you know, to be able to live. And then we could begin to ask, you know, who has it, who doesn't have it. And then as the book progresses, we end up in the final chapter, which is an N of 1. And an N of 1 is one person. So I work closely with the genomics pioneer, Professor Leroy Hood, who was one of the architects of the Human Genome Project. He's been a co-founder of 17 life science companies, and he created a new entity, a non-profit entity called Phenome Health in Seattle. And in a moment, I'll tell you what a phenome is. But you know, there's this idea that every individual on this call and every individual in the world is unique. Just like we all have our own fingerprint, we all have what's called a phenome. So the phenome is the dynamic interaction between your genes, you know, what you inherited from your mother and your father, which is specific to you, your environment. So from the moment you were conceived and in the womb until birth until now, you've lived in a certain environment, a physical environment, you know, a mental environment, a community environment. You might have lived in a place like Sarajevo during war, or you might have lived in the Outer Hebrides where it's very peaceful. So that will have affected your health trajectory. And then the third part of the phenome is your behavior. Do you choose that apple or do you choose those crisps on a regular basis? So the idea is that you can, using metrics that we can talk about later, using science and technology, you can actually measure how this dynamic interaction is going over time. So that last chapter, which is an N of 1, says, although all human beings share certain things in common, there are issues that are specific to certain races, certain genders, certain age groups, you name it. So the book actually, on the one hand, says all people have certain things in common. And at another level, it's like no people have anything in common. So in a way, to take an idea from a different world, the world of development, we are all special needs. We all have special needs, and yet we also have universal needs. So the healthcare system should be able to take account of our personalized needs, but also our needs as people. And the healthcare systems we have today, they really don't take account of either one.
And that's really fascinating. On one point of this, between the apple and the crisp, that you mentioned. Pauline Glazier says, our health will not improve while the food industry is allowed to peddle the ultra-processed junk that passes for food. Get rid of that and we might start getting people better. How much is that part of the well-being process, Robert?
Well, I don't agree with that because, I'm strongly influenced by a concept that I heard in a Jean Renoir French film many years ago, where the woman says to the man, every moment is fresh. So every moment is fresh. She said it with a French accent, which I don't do very well.
Okay.
So the idea that every moment is fresh means that rather than, you know, blaming some other people, and I don't disagree that ultra-processed food is not good for you, but, you know, I think at the heart of this is education. And I think children, when they go to school, they should be given nutritious food that's not ultra-processed. They should learn how and why they should eat an apple before they drink a soft drink and eat a chocolate bar. And it should be reinforced in the home. Now, realistically, a lot of children are raised in homes where these standards are not going to be there. And I think that's where the schools come in. Unfortunately, in parts of the United States, soft drink manufacturers and processed food makers, they actually pay school districts to either let them manage the food service or to carry their products. And often the schools are strapped for cash and they accept this. And I think if you're going to serve kids soft drinks at lunch in a school, I think that's, I'll be bold and say, I think that's unethical.
So in a way, because Sue Townley came in as you were saying that, right on the button of what you were saying, also finding a way to educate is hard to reach people. But you disagreed with Pauline a bit there, but is it the case that if your school is giving you these highly processed foods like the soft drink and that, and you're a child or even a parent in a not very well-off district, you don't have a choice unless those companies change their ways?
Well, you know, I mean, this is not really a program per se about political action, but I do think, you know, that the parents have a role to play in this. I think teachers have a role to play in this. I think school boards have a role to play in this. You know, there's all sorts of levels of governance around child rearing. Mm. And at some point, I think we have to strike a balance between holding the authorities accountable, you know, voting for people who support healthy policies, and on the other hand, taking personal responsibility, you know, for our own actions, and using the power of education, particularly with young people, to show them how and why healthy lifestyles are good for them, and why it feels better, you know, to have a nice salad with maybe a little protein on it versus six candy bars and three fizzy drinks. It just doesn't feel very good, even when you're 10.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. We are going to divert for a second because we have had some more guesses in. Hotel California, this is, no, it's not. Careless Whisper, suggests Sue Townley. Born to Run, says Celia. Maslow's Triangle.
I'll give you a tip. I'll give you a clue.
Yeah.
It is related to the impending seasonal change.
Related to the impending seasonal change. Sunshine of your love, says Cream. Sunshine, that could be.
It's not a season.
It's not a season.
Okay. So a season is in the title of the song.
Okay, Paula Radford. Summertime.
Yes, Paula's got it, Summertime. George Gershwin, Summertime. That's it. The reason why is that on March 19th is the beginning of spring. And of course, that on the beginning of spring, we all have a spring in our step, don't we? And we start thinking about summer and holidays at the beach and all the hot sand. And I thought to myself, I want to take us out of this program with an optimistic view of the future. And there's nothing more optimistic than summertime.
And you're not going to change your mind.
Well, don't forget, this is a live show and you asked me like moments ago to play something. And so I'm going to pick a horn up with no chart in front of me from my brain, play something.
Okay. No, and Paula Radford's giving us a fist bump. because, well done, Paula, you got it.
What does she win? What does she win?
She wins an applause from us all and a well-being boost.
There we go.
She's a brilliant Goldster guest on your show, Robert, and you will remember her for life.
I will.
I'm becoming totally fascinated in this idea. So I'm just going to read out to you, we've talked about it, Paradigm Shift to Wellness Revolution, and I want you to drill down more on it.
So in order for a paradigm shift to happen, I think from a move from an incredibly entrenched dominant paradigm, which is that the entire healthcare world is focused on disease. So it's not just that medical schools teach that and hospitals practice that and doctors deliver that. It's that most of us, including us on this call, somewhere we have been hardwired to believe that you go to the doctor when something breaks. That's what we think it is. It's almost like the Matrix. You know, it's like we're in a certain mindset and it's almost impossible to break that. So in order to facilitate, you know, a paradigm shift, as Kuhn talks about, you really need to approach it from a couple of perspectives. And you have to, it's all about people. It's all about changing people's minds and what they're committed to. So I believe that it's necessary to come from the top, so a top-down approach. So you gather together all the decision makers and the opinion leaders and all the experts you can possibly find. The downside is they're probably in silos, you know, so in the way that a psychiatrist doesn't tend to talk to a gynecologist, who doesn't tend to talk to a heart surgeon, you've got physicists who don't talk to economists and economists who don't talk to nurses. So, you know, to the project of this type, paradigm shift, by definition, can help begin to de-silo the experts and the decision makers, because we're going to ask a series of questions in the way that you're doing today, Humphrey, with me. Once you start asking questions, then people can jump out of their little holes and they can start talking. So there's a conversation that's possible. And to co-opt a phrase from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation at Princeton, we can begin to change the narrative about what health and healthcare is. So that's the top-down approach. Then there's the bottom-up approach. You know, the vast majority of human beings in the UK or the US or in the world are not decision makers on a big scale, and they're not opinion leaders, they're not professors or people like that. So the idea behind a 6-part documentary series that could be carried by Netflix or Amazon Prime or Hulu or something. In other words, a 6-part human interest series that explores how this paradigm shift will happen, how it will benefit people, and who are the change makers now? Change makers are people that are implementing new ways of thinking and making things happen in the world. They're often younger people. You know, showcase some change makers. And I have made arguments to some of the people I work with at Scientific American in New York City. I've said, look, 4.3% of all human beings alive today are not Americans. 96% are not Americans. So, and a lot of the world nowadays are young, and they're not Westerners even. So this series cannot just appeal to the likes of us. This has to be a series that appeals to all generations everywhere in the world, and that they can download it, you know, on their phone or on their computer, because now that's how people consume films.
I've put the two titles in because somebody said, what are they? The two titles and the thoughts that we're doing. We are almost out of time on this podcast section of this show. And I just want to say, what are you going to call it, the ascent of health or the ascent of well-being, based on your the catalyst, the inspiration that got you here?
You know what? I would say that we could modify Bernofsky's concept, and I would say it would be the ascent of humanity. Same. And I think that if humanity is healthy, it will be an ascendant. And I also think that we can be healthier, and we can be ascendant, and we could have a different ending to our series that will not be in a mud hole in a concentration camp in Poland. I guarantee it.
Robert, I want you to stay there for a second whilst I tell our podcast listeners and everybody what's coming up. We are then going to end recording, and for our live audience, we are going to open the floor to questions for you. So coming up on March the 12th, Betsy Gall joins us for a really important well-being issue, actually. How can we best help our doctors? Her husband, an oncologist, committed suicide. She now campaigns on this chilling trend among medical professionals, and her book's called The Illusion of a Perfect Profession. March 19th, Tim Edgebraten is a retired police chief, and he uses music to give him the rhythm of life. We'll have a guessing game with him as well. His motto is, I am, I can, I will. And his book is Find Your Beat. March 26th, the wonderful Lucinda is with us with Sarah Barnes and the emotional and physical benefits of cold water swimming. And April the 2nd, I'm with Marlene Wingfield, OBE, who campaigns for patient empowerment, guiding people through the labyrinth of the National Health Service. So that will be a gem on April the 2nd. Robert, is your health service more or less tricky to navigate than ours, do you reckon?
Well, I've lived in both places. Mm. I think ours is trickier because we don't have a healthcare system. We have many systems. And for example, in California, we have 59 counties and each one has its own system.
Oh my goodness. And at least we have a GP that takes us to our local hospital that gets us done. Yours sounds very complicated.
It's very complicated, which is why it's the most expensive in the world, and the health outcomes are not in the top 20.
Well, that's in Iris Wolf said, have you got a time limit on this? I think you're talking about the projects, are you, Iris? Is it 50 years? The time limit on your projects.
Well, the first actual deliverable will be the book, The Future of Human Care, Health Innovation and Social Impact. And That will come out later this year. And then we have already done one media project. If you go to Google and you put in Scientific American, The Science of Wellness, you can get access to a free 50-page, highly illustrated, beautiful piece that will talk all about the science of everything we mentioned today. Okay. That's available to you at no charge.
Yeah.
And then the Healthspan project, which is Living Better Longer, we're embarking on that one now. And then the film, I hope that we're going to begin filming sometime in the summer. And I think we're already developing some locations in Brazil. So I imagine we might film some traditional healers in the Amazon and then look at some state-of-the-art robots in Sao Paulo.
Oh, fantastic. And before we finish, the Goldster magazine question, which is we all have bleak days, we all have rough spots, we all get a bit down. Tell us in 15 seconds, what do you tell yourself to get through these grimmest times?
Most days, I'm perfectly imperfect, but most days in the morning and in the evening, I say a gratitude prayer. And it's not related to a religious belief, although I go to church, but it's not related. And I give thanks each morning and each evening for things that have happened that day that have been positive, empowering, and affirmative. And tonight, I will give thanks to you, Humphrey, and to this audience for this wonderful opportunity to share some of the ideas that I'm developing. Thank you.
Yeah. That's brilliant. That brought hairs on the back of my neck. That was wonderfully inspirational. Time's winged chariot is hurling towards us. I have learned so much about this paradigm shift, looking after ourselves and the changes of how people think about health. What a brilliant communicator we have had with us today. Thank you for all your questions, your comments, and your guesses on the saxophone tune, which we are about to hear. Until next week with Betsy Gall, stay active, stay generous, stay joyful, stay safe, and of course, stay gold. So thank you, Robert Kilpatrick, for being a wonderful Californian conversationalist, guest filled with wisdom and insight. Now, over to you to play us out.
So the entree is summertime and the living is easy. Fish are jumping and the cotton is high. Hum,
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Robert. Hope to see you again soon.
You've been listening to a Goldster Magazine Show podcast. Check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. We hope to tempt you, your family, and friends into the exciting world of helping everyone live healthier and happier for longer. Find more podcasts just by Googling Goldster and podcast. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and hope you're with us again soon.